Leon Brown. You are, of course, listening and or watching Man vs. Brand. So I want to talk to you about something that I feel like has been on my mind for a bit. And it's this conversation where we engage in what it takes to be an entrepreneur. Now, I know that a lot of you are coming to that conversation, maybe from the standpoint that entrepreneurs are born, that we inherently are charting courses that have not been laid out by anyone in front of us. We are, in fact, pioneers of innovation, pioneers of tech, of industry. And as such, we had no other option other than to be who we are. But there's another mindset that comes into play for me where entrepreneurs are birthed from necessity, that there is a need in the market, a need in our placement in an organization or company that says, I need to forge this thing for myself. That there's not another person, another brand, another entity that can deliver what I believe I can deliver. Now, does that mean that every entrepreneur is going to be successful? That we will have all of the rounded skills necessary in order for us to bring that thing into market? I don't know. I'm of the mindset that it takes a village in every part of our lives. That in business, in childhood, in becoming functioning adults, we need a village to support our aspirations. And I believe the same is true of what it takes to be an entrepreneur. But I'm no Elon Musk. I'm no Tim Dell. So I don't know. Maybe one day I'll just wake up and realize that I have one solid idea, that I've always had this idea, and that the world is just waiting for me to produce it. That I am, in fact, a genius entrepreneur and not just one of those guys working through problems, trying to find solutions. Well, I'm going to talk to someone who has gone through his own journey of trying to find solutions, who may, in fact, be an Elon Musk. We don't know. We're going to find out in this conversation right now. I'm talking to David Van Beekum. He's the co-founder of Tweeva. And he's going to talk to you about what he's doing over there. But more specifically, we're going to talk about his individual lived experience of becoming an entrepreneur, of becoming a co-founder, and what that's meant to not only him and his brand and company, but to his broader life. How has that informed his approach to not only what's happening professionally, but also personally? Because when we take on new roles, we, in fact, can become more evolved people. All right, guys. So I want you guys to enjoy the conversation we're about to have in 5, 4, 3.
Still trying to figure out the keys to life? Well, according to the locks, it's money, power, and respect. Learn to gain or grow these three concepts with Dion Brown and his podcast. With 20 years of expertise in guiding and coaching businesses and brands at the highest level, Dion is having the conversations that can lead to your big breakthrough. Welcome, and let's begin.
Anyway, if you're tired of listening to my voice, then I'm going to pass this over to David. David, what's up, buddy? Talk to the audience. How are you?
Hey, what's going on, Dion? Thanks for having me on the show. What an intro. Goodness gracious. I've never been compared to those kind of individuals. I'm not that smart.
Well, I think they would probably argue the same thing, right? At the onset of their stuff. Like, no one, everyone should believe they're great, right? But but not to the point that it's delusional. And I think that being an entrepreneur is delusional until that thing works out, right? Everyone's looking at you like you're crazy, right? Everyone's like, are you kidding me? Yep. We don't need another one of that. I'm not even sure about this, right? People don't see the vision until the vision has come into play. So I don't know if you're that guy.
That is for sure. Some people see things and some people don't. I totally agree with that statement because you can tell somebody, as you know, as an entrepreneur, when you're dreaming about something, you can kind of see it And you hear those, you ever see those memes on the internet? The couch was born in someone's mind before it was created. Like somebody was sitting on a rock or on a cloth bed on the ground thinking, I could sit straight up on a cushion. And people must have thought that was crazy. But it, it is very true. That vision comes first in your head. And you start thinking like, okay, I'm going down a rabbit hole. Might be called crazy, but this could be something cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, you know, to the earlier point, right? Like success leaves clues, right? So to the person that thought of the couch, they first had to see something of maybe a person resting on a wall that was also situated with a rock, right? And you start to see like, wow, that formation really could work out, right? And so as we're moving along, I think it's easy to believe that there is this inherent kind of genius that happens, right? Where we're pulling from the abstract thought and creating something concrete that has never been done. But in fact, I think some of the greatest entrepreneurs are also chroniclers or readers of history, right? They understand, you know, sort of what age we're in. Like they understand the industrial age. They understand what came out of it. They understand how to create scale based on other companies, right? And using that knowledge, they then add their genius to it and become greater.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. You have to find something that you know and you like. I mean, you don't want to be, if you want to be the only one, you have to really know that you're the only one. If you want to copy someone, well, you know, that's the best form of flattery, but it's not always the best way to do it. Yeah. But you do have to know a little bit about, you have to be a little bit of a nerd, I think, at some point. Like what, remember when we were growing up, that was, a nerd was a bad thing. And now today it's like grandma's a nerd, you know? Yeah. If anybody's in tech, it's a nerd and it's kind of a cool thing. But to the first version of the nerd, that's really what it was. It was a little bit of, I can read a little bit of statistics. I kind of know where there is a hole of opportunity and something I can do that could be profitable or great. And then how to create action steps to move that idea forward a few steps in history. Because sometimes people just don't look in certain directions.
Yeah, I mean, I think to understand how to think outside the box, you need to first understand the box, right? You need to understand what had come before, what didn't work, what did work, what you can improve upon, right? And that does, I think, take a level of nerdiness, a level of passion, a level of delusion, right? To just kind of be like, I can build on something and create from that something a new thing, right? A new thing that even if something similar has been in the market, my approach to this thing will more effectively create a solution, will be have broader appeal to the masses, right? There's something that I'm going to do that will be inherently different from this thing.
Yes. Yes. And you're, if your mind wanders, I'm thinking of these things as you're talking, I'm like, and if you have a mind that wanders, you know, if you're taking a shower and you're, oh my goodness, this could connect to that, could connect to this. And then you're driving in the car and you tune out, the kids are talking and the music's on and your brain's going, but what if we tried a zero or a one or a three or a, oh my goodness, that could, you know, it's a different way to think about issues and problems that really creates that kind of brain to say, I'll just try it. And they kind of get satisfaction out of figuring a problem out.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Yeah. I think to your point too, right? Like some of the best problem solving has come from very mundane situations, right? You're like, has to be a better way, right? Yeah. Like, or, you know, you could be faced at your company, an issue and find the solution from children playing or find the solution from something that's not related directly to the problem you're looking to solve, but has like a correlative kind of parallel dynamic that you can tap into in order to solve it.
Yeah, that is having that group dynamic to it. If you can inject the idea and, you know, maybe you spent a couple of weeks thinking about it into the team and now they're like, they can go work on the idea. I think that's the Elon Musk thing. This idea of when you first were creating the electric car, that must have been how many were there on the road? I mean, maybe there would have been one brand, other brand, or two brands. Well, no, I think maybe the big car companies did it right back in the 90s. Remember that movie, Who Killed the Electric Car? They got rid of electric cars.
So he had to then
bring it back and then inject it into the team and start to like rebuild that whole idea again, which is
right there. And I think to what you're saying, specifically about a team, but also about the timeliness of it, right? Is that not your team is working on an electric car. There's another team that's working on the capacity of recharging, right? Electric things, right? Maybe not the car, but electric things. And so you have these groups that may be working independently or may have some knowledge of the existence of the other working on things that are necessary for it to grow, right? Because the electric car, the big problem is that there needed to be an infrastructure that happened around it, right? And it's not until the present day that these things exist by having groups that are working on solutions that when come together, form something greater.
Yeah. Think about, it's not just the car then. He must have been dreaming up like a factory with robotic arms that are doing like, oh, we're going to need 1,000 arms. And I imagine the investors then, they'd be like, are you crazy? What do you think the world's going to be in 20 years? You know?
Talk to me about this crazy idea. Talk to me about this crazy company that you have co-founded and what's its aim in the world?
Well, you know, it goes back. I didn't realize this until I really started talking to people. Like I've been building and programming and engineering the product. But when you really start talking about it, I'm like, wow, this really started a lot younger in my life than it is now. Like I had a 16 channel audio Mackie board underneath my bunk bed at like 10. And then I had a reel to reel tape recorder, a record player, two VCRs, a video studio, and an old 480 line camera. And I would do like news with my sister and my brother. And then we'd kind of just play around with this old equipment. And I'm going like, wow, maybe that did play a role in it. But it's funny how you're talking about the entrepreneurial life of all of the pieces that you kind of have experience with. When those opportunities arise, you kind of just look at it and go, yeah, I could do that. I could kind of build that. And that's kind of how Tweeva came about. Now, it wasn't sparked by me, but it was like I didn't see something that I couldn't do. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs do that. Tweeva. So let me explain a little bit about it. It's a social TV platform for you and me and small businesses. Okay. So the idea is that you have a TV in your business. I have a TV in my business. What are we showing on it? We're going to show maybe a Netflix, maybe show a local TV commercial or a local TV channel. Why can't we show something about the town? Why can't we allow influencers to walk into the building, shoot some great content of the food, and then bloop, they just share it up on the TV?
Yeah.
So broadly, that's what it is.
Now, there are folks, companies, businesses, right, that sort of create something similar, right? Where maybe you're at a restaurant, you're looking at plated food or a menu, let's say. Menu is probably more common, right? So you're looking at maybe a flat screen and you're seeing a menu. Maybe you walk into a real estate office and you see like what they have as inventory, right, moving across the screen. What makes the experience different than maybe some of these more sort of static sort of situations where you're looking at maybe stills or you're looking at a quick 25 seconds and you don't really have very much context as to what you're looking at, but you understand that it in some way relates to the physical space you're in?
Well, that would be just what it is. It's a 25 second to 30 second attention span.
Yeah.
Or, hey, I know I'm in a real estate office. And I can see the TV and I can see the screens. Okay, that's cool. Okay, I got it. I know what it is. I know it's there.
Yeah.
But it's done, right? Yeah. There's no two-way communication. So yeah. I said, could we create a way? I mean, not I, but the team, can we create a way that when I'm there, can I share something that I like? You know, maybe it's a real estate house that I liked or a beachfront property or just a favorite photo of my dog or the 4th of July parade, something. Like, can it be, can these screens that just push content to us be two way? And we kind of played with that idea for a while. Like, well, you'd have to, moderate the content. Oh, well, you'd have to give them an app. Well, are we going to pay for this? You know, and there's a lot of pieces that go into it. But it is, think of it as a two-way display that you can kind of interact with.
Yeah. So what hurdles, aside from maybe just presenting it to market, right? What hurdles did you personally confront and overcome in order to get the company's idea into the market? Like what did you face when you were first like introduced to the team, bringing the idea, sort of those first iterative stages when you were like, okay, we have this idea, right? And then we have whatever this idea is, and then we have whatever we actually brought into market. What were some of the obstacles and how'd you get over them?
That's the funny part of it, is like every single thing was a brick wall. Like every single thing. I mean, we had hammers sitting there, but everything you tried to do was, that doesn't work, or you'd have to do it this way. I mean, we started so simple, like a PowerPoint, just load a PowerPoint on a USB stick and just play it and see what the interaction was. And then, oh goodness, you can't update that. I'm not driving around town putting new sticks in the backs of TVs.
Yeah. Right?
So even at the basic form level, the branding name, that was an issue. The literally all of the pieces were hard to do. And I could swear that's why it doesn't really exist yet. Because each one was some sort of battle. Many different pieces of hardware to go through to find something that can sustain the longevity of being on most of the time. It's not like a TV, you know, that you just turn on for a couple of hours at night and then it turns off. I mean, this thing has to run all day long. Yeah. So can you 3D print it? Okay, yes. But if it heats up too much, you'll melt the plastic. Okay, can we put a fan in it? Okay, what about the bearings? Well, those go bad after 6 months of running 24/7.
Yeah.
Everything you can think of. And that's the difference, though, between like an entrepreneurial view of like heavily optimistic.
Yeah.
And just saying like, cool, that didn't work. Like, is there a different type of ball bearing in a motor? You know, and I think a lot of entrepreneurs are like that. They just sit there and they ponder and they think like, yeah, but we could try this. And they don't look at it as like a failure, you know?
And I think that goes to that earlier point that I was trying to drive to the audience in this conversation, which is success leaves clues, right? Like just because you're not successful in this space doesn't mean that another person hasn't solved that problem for you. You just have to find the solution that they discovered and then apply that to your failed problem. Right. And I think fail is a term that, you know, you're just not successful in the moment. Right. You're inching toward the threshold in which you'll be successful. There's something funny that not necessarily funny. It's an interesting concept that I was introduced to later in life in my professional entrepreneurial journey, which is an estimation of how many times you will need to not succeed at something in order for it to work, right? Like, like just gaining the math around that. And it came from, I think, cold calling, right? So I think that there was this idea that was introduced in cold calling is how many no's until you reach your yes, right? And people were trained in this idea that you're going to, on average, let's say, for any given call, get 30 no's before you get a yes. So therefore, you need to make 31 calls to hit your yes. Well, something similar exists in being an entrepreneur where you may have to have X amount of failures till you succeed.
Yeah.
And that thing is in a hard number. It's not like you're definitively going to go through 31 or 30 fails till you succeed. But there's an idea that if at your first attempt, you're banking on it being a win, you're banking on it being successful, then you might be missing out on the entirety of the process by being so focused on getting it right the first time.
Yeah. Cold calling is an industry standard. You know, millions of people do it. They have stats on it. But when you're creating something that somebody has not done before, you're right. You literally have to enjoy the process of failing. Like it would be 11:30 and I'm like 4 more hours till the 4 boxes are done being printed. And I'd love it. It was just fun. And then, I get another color in so I could print the logo different. It's fun. And I think that's part of that type of personality that just likes to work in tech or is enamored with that type of technology, because cold calling is fun, but not that much fun for me. Right.
No, I don't think it's fun for any, there's certain personality types that
certain personalities love that. They love
people,
right? They do that all day long. And if you say, go stare at that line of code and see where the semicolon was missing, they'd be like, oh no. I'd rather call 100 people and get 100 no's.
Yeah.
That's really what they'd rather do. But that's what makes the team, like you talked about before too, you got to find that correct person to take the idea and mold it. And like I thought you said, you know, how many times does it get there? I'm like, it's kind of like building a sandcastle in a rainstorm.
Yeah.
You know, like you just put something there and it's like kind of falls apart and you try to like, well, that's not going to work. And you just keep trying and trying until the rain stops. And then you're like, okay, I got an idea of where I want things. And you can start building it. But it's like you have to get through that storm first.
Yeah. And I think to your analogy, I think that at that point, moving forward, the rain doesn't seem as bad. When you've learned to deal with the rain, then you start to create contingencies and a mindset that's focused on not letting the particulars of how this thing has come to be the determiner of whether it will be or not, right? So you're like, I built a sandcastle in the rain. Now that it's windy, I'm good. We're just going to wait for the wind, right? I'm still going to keep building through the wind, right? Oh, like something else happened, right? And I'm just going to keep pushing through, right? Because I think that this is a beautiful thing to have success from the onset. But I also think, right, just out the gate, you did something, it sort of blew up, right? But I think if you haven't really learned about your own personal process and the process of developing something, it can hinder you because you don't really have a solid foundation of information to replicate that thing again, right? Some of the best serial entrepreneurs failed early on. And because of that failure, they're able to replicate the success because they're able to like already see where some of those pitfalls are and kind of navigate their way around it.
As opposed to mitigating risk.
Yeah, like my first idea, I made millions of dollars on it, right? And someone's like, do it again. And they're like, not quite sure how that even happened, right?
I won once too at the casino, but that doesn't mean much in your second, third, fourth, fifth visit. It's not, doesn't mean that you've mitigated risk enough to move forward with $1 million, you know?
Yeah.
Because you put a quarter in and got lucky. No, there's definitely truth to that. And you become a little, when you have that success first, you're like, okay, yeah, you just tell this, you just do this, you do that. But you don't really understand why, or you don't put a person in there that really understands the product as much. And that could be a 6 month to 8 to 2 year decision that's gone poor.
Yeah.
You know,
and guys, I know this sounds like it's like, well, who really comes out the gate and just wins? But there's a lot of successful startups where the founder can't really articulate why they're successful. And it's one of those things where, you know, I think that even that idea, if you're not within a great network and you don't have folks that you trust, can also lead one to become very insecure in their own entrepreneurial journey, right? Like that's where I think you see a lot of like not sharing ideas, a lot of compartmentalization of folks and thoughts, right? No dissension, right? Anything that is that is meant towards progress and change and culture, right, is often looked at as dissension because the person's really afraid that someone will recognize that they may not be the visionary that the result of the company would indicate, right? You hear a lot of stories about these kind of maverick entrepreneurs, but then you hear like the culture was really toxic and people couldn't really talk and share. I think a lot of that tends to be that the person in charge may not have gone through enough of the journey of being an entrepreneur where they are afraid that they're not showing up as the result of their company.
Yeah, that happens if like that one person may have a connection and you know that you can fail and go get either more money or more capital. And so they just push their way through. Yeah. And it doesn't always mean that they
talk just resonated with you or could help someone you know. Follow Dion or his guest on all social media platforms. Till next time. And remember, with any business or brand, give it your heart, make it real, or else forget about it. See you all soon.
Facebook was built in a college dorm because of the timing of when it was. And because nobody was using, repositories to hold their code and share them with programmers based upon access levels, he might have done specific things like that that were different from many others at the time. Yeah. But today, try to do that, right? You're not going to be in the same spot in 20 years because the timing, the money, the capital, a lot of the risks are completely different now. And there's so many copycats. So to be first to market, to have your idea, to share, there's a lot. I mean, it almost seems like the whole startup world, all these variables are changing so quick, you know, compared to 10 or 20 years ago. And I'm sure it is because of technology, AI, right? Yeah. Everything's moving so quick. It's hard to nail down an exact scientific formula for a successful startup. Would you agree?
Yeah, I very much agree. And I think that this idea that, you know, more money ensures success really now looks like more money can buffer you from failure, but it can't guarantee success, right? This idea that just more capital infused in your company, right? You're gonna win, right? It's just a matter of time. And I think we're finding out that that's not true. It just stalls your failure if the thing that you're creating or the thing that you're producing doesn't really have market viability. Sometimes experience and ingenuity will get you places, right? Now, money's important. Money's important, guys. Don't let me tell you differently. Money's important. If you don't have it, then you better have a killer guerrilla marketing program. I don't even know what to tell you if you don't have it. But what I will say is that throwing more money at something that doesn't work doesn't actually fix it.
Yeah. Today, unlike the past, I guess you could in the past, but everything's becoming more complicated. So air and money are very equal in the same startup world. You need the money to get to the level of complexity to compete anywhere. Because again, you're trying to create something. You need to be in competition with another team, like you said, right?
Yeah.
So you need to have smart people on the team and to be able to expand and grow, throw out ideas, and change things on a whim, pivot and move, because again, you're competing not just against you, but against teams of other people. And they might have access to capital, right? Yeah. More capital.
And I think what you're saying is important because more money, all it does is scale what's already there, right? So if you are nimble, if you are agile, if you do listen to your customer, if you are interested in exploring new markets and new ideas, then more money provides more opportunity and resources for that. if you aren't those things, and more money only amplifies the fact that you aren't those things, where you're putting more money into things that don't really authentically and truly move the needle of your company, right? Where you're not seeing the type of scale and the type of growth that you probably want to see, because maybe you're not, in fact, investing those resources into the parts of your company that really need that infusion of cash, right? Because
I would imagine,
right, that like you decide that you want to start a company, right? You personally, David, go, I want to start a company. And your first thought is, how can I get this thing off the ground? You know, how can I really change lives, right? What can I do? And then, boom, you're out of savings, trying to borrow, trying to figure it out. Well, depending on how well you can articulate your idea, how much of the minimally viable product that you could produce, right? The least that you could produce with the most resources available to you will start to determine how people feel about it. Now, in this analogy, I may not know you, David, but if I know that you have a really great idea, you have solid financials, I might be more willing to invest in this thing, right? I may be more willing to tell someone that I know about this idea. On the other hand, if you become an entrepreneur and you're like, man, I want to work less hours. I want to make a ton of cash really quickly. I want stock options right now, right? Then yes, you may still have the same effect, right? You may still produce this really great thing, but the way in which you discuss it and go about it may feel differently. So you may have to go through some other channels in order to get buy-in from folks, right? And I think that a lot of entrepreneurs, I'm coming to a point, I think, in this analogy, but I think a lot of folks approach entrepreneurship from oftentimes those two very different sort of ways of looking at it, right? Like there are folks that are like, I want to be an entrepreneur because I don't want to work for someone else, which is valid. I want to be an entrepreneur because I want to make a ton of money from my ideas, which is valid, right? But that ideology may come across to others that may say, well, how valuable is this thing? Aside from you just wanting to like not work 40 hours, how valuable is this thing, right? Where there's others that come to it from a standpoint of, I want to problem solve. I want to fix something. I want to innovate on something that's already been created. Now, which of the two did you come to this journey at? There's no value on either one, but which one? Because I find that people tend to come to it from those two very, or maybe a combination of both, but from those two very different approaches. Was it like the way that I'm working feels like it can be changed, or something in the world needs to be changed, and I think I could be the person to help?
Ooh, well, you know, I came from the first part where I think at a young age, I realized I'm not allowed to speak my mind working with others. And well, it started with first physical labor. You know, I don't like physical labor as much as because my brain would move, right, very quickly. And so I realized I didn't like that. But then I realized I didn't like working for people at 15, right? So I think since 16 or 17, I really haven't had a job working for anyone. I've just built things like I've worked with people, but not as a job. And I've always just took that approach of I can do it in my time. I could figure it out. But you do that for so long. And that's not, like you said, there is value in that. Yeah. But that's called an inventor, I think.
Yeah.
I think that's more called inventor, because what you're describing is, okay, I don't want to work a long time. I want to invent. I want to change the world with something, but I don't want to work that hard. Inventing doesn't involve necessarily a company. An inventor could invent something with a lawyer and then sell the license to that invention to a large company.
Yep.
And what is a company? Well, a company is a bunch of people, friends, with money attached. It's like you're trying to, I mean, people look at the opposite way. They're like, oh, well, you should really like the people that you work for. Well, why don't you find the people that like each other and then have them work together? Wouldn't that be an easier way? Because a company and business is, well, I usually say that business is friendships with money attached. Because if you're a sucky friend.
And contract, right? Because I think the thing that you said about the lawyer is an important part of that friendship element.
Yes.
Is that when you have money and you guys are in business, having really solid contracts will mitigate some of the conflict that it is in being friends in business. You have solid contracts and a lawyer is done, then you can go along being friends and you don't have to worry about the way that things fall out, right?
Yep. But even if you were friends with them and had contracts, if you hate the person, you're not going to want to like share your ideas. You're not going to want to really, like you talked about, you that guy that holds back a little. It's like you're not going to really want to say, oh, can we try this idea? Because you know you don't like the guy. He doesn't like you. He's going to try to take you down, right? So you've got to find these people. But this is what, this is a company. That's different because you go out into the world and you say, I want to change the world. But yeah, but you can't do it yourself. Yeah. Okay, well, then I'll train a bunch of people to do it. Well, most likely that's not going to be the inventor who's like sitting there with a pen and a, you know, electronics. Like, okay, I'm going to fix everything I can with this problem. Right, I'm going to reinvent something. That's the nerdy inventor type.
Yeah.
But people think that those, they're just an entrepreneur. But you got to know the difference. There is a difference. You just have a vision. You have a great idea. You need to find somebody that's good with people then, because you may really be good. You may be really good at analytical things and figuring out problems, but that whole building a company and keeping them employed, you know, people say things about Steve Jobs and about other big, I don't know if everybody would be like, he's the nicest guy in the world. Right. Yeah. It could be, maybe they only see him 10 minutes though, a month at a meeting and he's rah, rah, rah. But a lot of the times they don't have the best other relationships because people have their little boxes that they work in. But as entrepreneurs, we all sit there and dream like, oh, I could do this, I could do that. You really have to do a little bit of research into what do you do really, really well. And if you want to change the world and if you want to do this, well, then first things first, if you can lock down your idea, get a lawyer, get that, and then just go find somebody that has an equal of good passion. Completely opposite than you, because two or three people, four people on a team that are completely opposites that like each other.
Yeah.
Very hard to find.
Yeah.
But are extremely successful.
I think that there's something interesting, something really kind of profound in what you said, or at least what I'm also getting from what you're saying is that there may be times in which folks are producing companies when in fact their intent is to go it alone, right? Folks are creating companies when they really want to be inventors. And because of it, the company starts to feel as if it's weighing them down instead of scaling what they want to produce in the world, right? Because we all think like, okay, if I have a great idea, I need to be an entrepreneur. I need to have an LLC. I need to bring in folks. I need a marketing person. I need this. I need that. Right. And then all of a sudden you're in the operations process. You're in the recruitment process. You're probably at the start in the marketing process. You're in the pitch meeting process, right? When really all you want to do is make something, get it out there. Right. But because we're taught that we need to build companies around it. Not saying that, I guess I'm going to clarify that. LLCs are really about how you're taxed. And that's an important part of this process. What I'm saying, though, is that sometimes we create complicated companies to deliver something that might be simplified if only we spent time talking to legal entities like lawyers to figure out the best way to approach what it is that we want to do, right? Instead of just going out there and saying, you know, I need all of these resources to make this thing happen. Sometimes we may have everything that we need and we're just creating more weight around the thing that we're doing as opposed to moving forward with it in the way that we really and truly intend to.
Yeah. That, I was just thinking, is this like a Tony Robbins, all that I have within me now? I have all that I have within me now. That's the mantra of every startup personality. It's completely, don't think about that. That's good for personal, but don't think about that in that business world. Otherwise, you'll end up working 100 hours a week trying to say, I know the marketing better than everyone else. I know this better than everyone else. Oh, I just talked to my lawyer and he said that I should do this. Your lawyer's not building a 100 employee company, right? He's working on a million different cases and he can compartmentalize you for 15, 30, 45 an hour. That's what he does. And then he charges you for it. Yeah. You need to go to a business expert, someone who has built a team. If that's the goal, right? If you want to build a social media company and have 50 to 100 people work in an office downtown, you're not going to say all that I have was doing, I'm just going to do everything myself and have this thing grow. It's going to take a lot of people, a lot of connections, because it just doesn't work that way. And if you think about it, a lot of businesses are they have a problem with scale. A lot of people have great ideas, but it's hard to scale it because there's people involved. People are the major variable. It's like, you know, computers, you can say true or false. Tomorrow, if you set that Boolean variable, what is it? It's exactly what you left it at. Yeah. It doesn't feel sick. It doesn't do this. It doesn't do that. So you can build a system. Anybody can build a system, but it's the people. It's how do you get them to move forward? How do you get them to move forward with a not scammy look on their face about them not believing what the product is?
Yeah.
I sometimes sit back and I go, oh, okay. That's why they're paying, you know, these CEOs so much.
Yeah.
Because it's not about, oh, well, I worked, you know, 5 years ago and I programmed that thing and the system's still working. Oh, no. There is so many variables in people. And if people like people, then what if that person leaves? So it becomes a very large piece of moving gears every single day. And I don't think a lot of entrepreneurs think that it's that complicated. I just think that, okay, well, I'll add one person and then I'll add two and I'll grow here. And in 5 years, I want to be here. But if you read through a couple of books on what CEOs had to go through and how just major market cycles work and how people fall apart at certain times in history, it's like you're rebuilding everything from scratch again. Yeah. So it really is a really complex thing to do when you're talking inventing a product or building a company. It really should have like some sort of trumpet intro for that one. This is a big one, guys. Remember, it's hard to do this.
Yeah. And I think too, in addition to market cycles and managing personalities, you also have the life cycle of your company. Like sometimes to start something doesn't mean that you're the person to scale it. Like sometimes to determine whether, you know, to go public or not, you need a different person than the person who maybe founded it, who has this sort of, I want to keep it personal sort of relationship to it, right? Like sometimes you as a leader have to understand whether your evolution is working in tandem to your company's evolution, right? And are you in fact the best person to lead it into its next 10, 20, 30 years? And also approach that in an objective sort of way. Like, I'm going to do what's best for this company, not necessarily what feeds my ego.
Oh, this is a great little analogy story in here is, okay, so you talk to a couple people to go public, you have to about $70 million in revenue. Okay, so you sit there and you're going to spend because, you know, you're determined and you're happy and you figured out a problem. So I'm going to sit here and build an Excel spreadsheet of what I need to do to get public, right? Okay, So then you're browsing around on Facebook and you find people just like, it looks a little bit like, I don't know if I could trust you, but he said, call me. So you call and he's a merger and acquisition person. Yeah. And you learn new things like, well, Dave, why would you build, let's say you're at 10,000 users. You're going to try to scale to 100,000 users. Is that really the best idea? Or can you go buy a startup from a pimply faced kid who out of high school who wants to sell it for $100,000?
Yeah.
Hey, Dad, first app I sold it. And it has 50,000 subscribers on it.
Yeah.
Now you mold those people in. and you do it second time. So for $200,000, you're now at your goal. Then you go immediately to an acquisitions and mergers company and say, hey, we have 120,000 people, da-da-da-da-da. You buy a shell corporation, boom, now you're public.
Yeah.
That takes 5 years off of the whole idea.
Yeah.
And so this is what I'm talking about is we think we really know. But when you start networking and talking to other people and figuring out what the actual companies that me and you see successful in the market, in everywhere, there's stuff happening behind the scenes. Yeah, maybe the story is, okay, he did this in college and then, you know, he got a couple friends and he went through a couple lawsuits. We'll make him a movie about him.
Yeah.
I doubt it's the whole entire truth of everything that happens, right? There's got to be stuff that goes on behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Now, the difference between those two roads is like one relationship.
Yep.
One. And we don't think of it like that. We just think, okay, I'm in it for the long haul. I'll just give it all I got and move and go. And 10 years later, oh, well, it didn't work. Well, guess what? You know, it's those kind of things. So we really need to network more and share more and help each other. Well, we're not going to help our competitors, but you know what I mean? Like there's business groups and accelerator groups that you can meet a lot of unique people out there and save many, many hours, if not years, off of what you're trying to accomplish.
Absolutely. And in addition, right, you're making so many great points that I feel like all I have is, and in addition to that, right? But in addition, I think that
I love what you're saying. I'm building off of what you got. So.
Absolutely. Listen. In addition, I think that you bring up a really great point around like age and concept, right? Is that, you know, so many people may be under the false impression that if you didn't get it in your college dorm room, then you just don't have the sauce, right? That you've missed out on your window for creating something great. But in my personal life, as I've gotten older, I have built better relationships that now allow me to actualize on ideas faster because I have an infrastructure to do so that I might not have had when I was in college. I know I didn't have it in college. I know some really smart people, right? But we just didn't have the same infrastructure that I have right now, right? And so, you know, just the folks that are listening, you may be working right now, you may be a leader, you may be a coach, you may be in one set of business and have a really great idea for another, right? Like lean into the network that you already have to come together. And if you don't feel like you have the appropriate network, then go out to some groups, some pitch groups, accelerator groups, right? Like go out there in the world and learn and connect with people. Not in a transactional way, but in a way of like investing what you have to offer and then allowing them to bring value also. And you'll find that what you lacked in creating Facebook in a college dorm, you may actually be able to get done faster now because you're able to better articulate, you're better able to manage, you're better able to be more specific and time blocked with your activities. You just may be a person that's more fit to do the thing that you want to do now than you were then. And that doesn't change the fact that you are going to end up as an entrepreneur.
Yes, absolutely. That communication and that networking, like you were talking about earlier, how a lot of entrepreneurs get to the point where they spend everything that they have and they're spending their savings on that hope and prayer. And that was the delusion of either you have an invention or you have the company, those two roads. And if you don't know, you take one route and you'd spend all your money.
Yeah.
Keep the money in the bank, keep your idea to yourself and go work with an entrepreneur, somebody in one of those business networking groups and just say, hey, I want to peer over your shoulder to do some of the marketing that you do, or I want to take notes. I'll take notes with a pen or an AI app with this thing at next five meetings. And I'll take highlights and notes and send it back to you on an email. You would learn more for less money. Or, I mean, you can keep your savings. You can keep your money. And you learn a couple tips here and there. One program that people may use, an AI-generated program is going to save you from writing a document, right? Like, how much time does ChatGPT serve versus writing a Word document?
You know?
So, or getting a contract or an idea of a contract. So you think about the same way, you're getting that knowledge from somebody who is either older or they are more experienced. And you can still keep that money that you have. Don't risk it yet. But you'll hit a time where you're just like, okay, I kind of know where I need to place this. And if you have these relationships fostered already with some of these people that you've worked with, it's much easier to go to them now and say, hey, you know, I'm ready to take this jump. What do you think I should do with it? And there's this thing in the VC world. It's like, if you want money, ask for help. If you want help, ask for money.
Yep.
Because everybody wants to give your opinion when you want to ask for that money. But if you can go to them and say, okay, no, trust me, I got the money over here, but I need to do this, this, and this. And he might say, well, you got all your ducks in a row.
Yeah.
What would you do with an extra 100K on this side? And you'll have your spreadsheet set out because you built him a spreadsheet, right?
Yeah.
If you had to model a financial, you know, 3-year plan for an investor group, you're going to know these little things. I know it's a lot. This is a lot of information, but it's things that you learn. And if you want to build a big company, right?
Yeah.
Or you can just do something small and still be an entrepreneur. But that's you got to pick one of those roads to go down.
And to what you said earlier, if you're not that person, you need to find someone who is that person that you work with, that you like, who believes in the vision, who can articulate that thing for you. You find with a lot of the more famous entrepreneurs and founders of companies that they had a team of individuals that did the parts that they weren't successful at. Yeah, you may know the name Steve Jobs, you may, you know Bill Gates, right? But around them were also individuals that were specialists in any particular role, and their specialization in that role helped to allow the central figure around the company to do what they did best, whether it was the tech side, whether it was the marketing and presentation side, whether it was the raising of capital side, whatever it is that that person did, they were able to do it and to focus on that one thing that they could do best because they had others around them who were specialists in what they did.
Yes. And you, and that's what makes it successful, or don't go down that road. I was listening to an interview with the Amazon, Mr. Amazon. What's his name? I'm going down every other node in my brain. So
yeah, no, literally, I'm all right. Everyone in the podcast is going to be screaming out the answer.
Yeah, they're like,
answer, guys. We're joking.
So he was saying, how do you think you guys came? How do you think we came up with Prime shipping? Like Amazon Prime. And they're like, well, it's just free shipping. It's simple. He's like, no, it's a very costly thing to give free shipping. And so he's like, it actually came from a junior developer that came in and said at one of these round tables, can we do like an all you can eat buffet for boxes? Like, and you can get whatever box you want. And what? Why don't you say it's free shipping? Because he thought, if you could see anything that you wanted, could you just pick it and get it at your house? So he brought it to the team as all you can eat buffet for everything on Amazon. Now, they took that idea and he said they modeled it financially, which was, he's like, we couldn't do it. Like, you lose so much money. You have to put in the infrastructure and da 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 da. Then they, you know, spun it around for 4, 5, 6 months before they came up with something. Then they had to go talk to the investors. What's the cost of acquiring a customer? Is it $50? You know, okay, what if he leaves and finds it somebody else? Then it's $100? Or what's the total lifetime cost of acquiring someone and then having them leave, right? So there's a lot of pieces. Now, it's not just him doing it. He has a team that has to go model that in the 3rd, 5th, 7th, 10th, 20th year, the brandability of free shipping, all these things. Now, but it came at the programming level in not even the same thing that it's called.
Yeah.
And you have to think, like, some people call it pivoting, but it's really a mishmash of, I have an idea. I think it'll benefit just about everybody. Let's see what we can do with it. And it's like they all got together and just said, okay, well, we all agree it's kind of a good idea. Now we have to figure out the logistics and the financial viability of how we could do something. But if we did, it would be amazing and nobody would stop using it. Yeah. And so here we are with the success. And he said, yeah, but remember, for every one of those, there is probably 10 or 20 or 30 failures. And he mentioned the Fire phone. Amazon had their own phone and it's not in existence anymore. So you have to be willing to share the idea, model it out, try to figure out what you could be, you know, long-term success of that idea. And then also throw out ones, well, you know, I'm trying to say like throw it in the, like a one that doesn't work. You have to be willing to let it go. That's the better word. Let go of the Fire phone.
Absolutely. And then learn Jeff Bezos.
Jeff Bezos. There we go.
Can't believe it. We're going to leave that in. We'll leave that in production. We're gonna leave this in for the full ride. Sometimes, and this, guys, lets you know that this thing is happening off the cuff because you know, people would just like blend that in. All right. So, yeah, like you have to let the Fire phone go. You have to know if that really is going to move the needle for your company or if you're the person to, or you're the company to best deliver that into market. And what can you add to that product or add to that idea that really changes it? But also in the conversation that you described is this sense that it didn't come from a peer per se, right? It came from someone who, you know, it would be easy to say, well, I'm Jeff Bezos. I'm going to keep saying the name. Right? I can say like, you know, I'm him. I have all of the keys. I have all of the ideas, right? I have birthed this thing and therefore no one in this company can think of something that I have not thought of. You could take that approach, or you could listen to great ideas and build a company that fosters great ideas.
That's like inventor versus
company. I have a great one. I met a woman. I was working in an e-commerce company. I was over maybe marketing, communications, PR, something like that. She came in. She was over innovation. And she told a story of how, now guys, as of this, I don't know if this is the truth. And I looked into it a bit while we were having the conversation, maybe about 8 years ago, but that you had to cross-functionally work in other Amazon departments. So you might start in engineering and then move into part of the company that dealt in engineering, but not specific to why you were introduced to the company. Or you might work on white label products or ideas or concepts that they had, with the idea that sometimes finding the space that you'll add the most value isn't the space that you come into. And that this sort of shifting of roles and of talent into different spaces might create something in that space that wouldn't have existed if that talent wasn't shifted around. Right. And so there was like a sort of this idea that there was like a minimal amount of movement that you had to make. Right. And pivoting in your space that you had to make in order to be successful at the company. And I think that harkens to an idea that, you know, that the talent, allowing the talent that you've hired to be talented, right? Instead of hiring talented people and then encasing them in your ego or what your ego would allow for, right? You let talented people be talented. You don't let them overrun your company. You don't let them, you know, take money, time, and resources and do whatever they want. But I think if you trust that you're surrounded with talented people, that you allow those people to in fact be talented and not allow what you believe the company should be unilaterally be the only determiner for what scale and progress and success looks like. That's another support of Amazon philosophy.
No, that's I've never heard of the moving around, but that makes a lot of sense. And that almost shows that you can share and you can work with different types of personalities. Like, you're not going to just get that inventor type in, you know, they're going to have to say, can I work on both roads? Can I go down both different avenues? Can I work a little bit in marketing and understand their thinking before I suggest an idea of all you can eat free shipping or all you can write products? And so that's a very interesting way to go about it. But that shows exactly the road that he's on. It's company.
Yeah.
It's literally company. Now he's writing both. Like, he invents things, right? I'm sure they run patents on certain parts of their warehouses and those little robots that deliver the stuff. But he's not focusing on that. I doubt he tells the investors, okay, we need $50 billion for a little, new motors for the robots. I doubt it. He's pushing the idea that this is a people-run company and it's going to be for people and the relationships. Right? I imagine he's going down that road. But that just shows the difference between a huge company and just that single road of, well, I want to be rich and happy and design something cool, which is, there's nothing wrong with either side. I tend to think, though, I don't know, do you think both are the same amount of work?
I think
the company is more.
I mean, well, I think it depends on your personality type, actually. I think when we talk about more work or less work, I think that on an individual leadership standpoint, right? Like, there are some, like we said with the cold callers, right, who would rather talk to 100 people than review code, right? Then there are people that want to review code all day and rather than talk to 100 people. When we ask either person to do what is not their natural inclination, there is a learning curve, there's work that needs to be done, there's adjustment in approach, right? And that just creates more work. Now, that doesn't, I don't think that means that the work does not have mass effect, that it is not beneficial overall, right? But I do think that when you're moving against your natural inclination and you're breaking through ability ceilings as a person, as an individual, then I think that it does create more work. I know that there are people that have started companies for whom getting buy-in, getting people to join is simple for them, right? And then I know folks that have really genius ideas, really genius execution, but that struggle at the advocacy of the idea, the marketing of the idea, the having people join them on their journey. And because of it, they view all other parts other than the production of that thing that they're focused on as the work.
Oh, yeah. And then that goes down to that personality of what you enjoy to do. Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Because if you have one personality, if you're a person who loves to build companies, but you're not an execution person, then you have great vision, but you fail at bringing that thing into market successfully. Right. And if you're a person that loves a great product and focus on the product, but don't have buy-in, you have this really great idea, but you have no infrastructure to support it. And I think not having the balance of both really becomes to the detriment of the company until a solution is found, until someone comes along and goes, hey, you have this really great company, you have this really great culture, but you know, you kind of had some missteps in bringing this thing to light. Let me get into the technical parts of this and help you figure this thing out, right? Because ultimately, what is the true difference in the Ubers versus the Lyfts versus the Vias versus the other companies, right? What allows for, you know, a company to have a really great idea, but not necessarily move forward, right? Or that has all the technical portions, but not necessarily the company infrastructure to deliver, right? And I think that I'm broadly generalizing by describing those different applications, but I think there's something to the ingredients and the way in which those companies were formed, and an investigative look at the leadership of those companies and what you can see in how those companies were formed, the culture in which they were formed, and what's come out of it. And you can start to see some patterns in leadership and how leadership can contribute to the success or failure of a company and the work in which it takes for that company to round out the parts that they weren't initially successful in.
You know, it's weird. That hasn't changed, really.
Yeah.
I mean, tech, okay, it's a different shovel. But what you're talking about in the leadership side of things and building the people side of the company really hasn't changed. Okay, Zoom, but you still need face-to-face. You still need those relationships. You still need all of the things that we had for years and years and years. And so I'll say that. And then the second one is, I think that's why we all love to watch Shark Tank, because you are watching someone that has struggled for a long time, that's missing one of the three people in his company, or one or two of the three, or two of the four, right? And they're coming to this little stage of five people that have completely different talents, saying, okay, which one is going to fit, that's not me, right, that doesn't have necessarily my skills, could fit in here? And we watch it over and over and over again, but it's literally just the same thing happening, right? It's someone's worked on a product and they can bring it just this far until, okay, maybe this is gone, maybe that's gone, or they just know I need to get to this next level, and they're ready and they're ready to go. And that's, I think we need to take that thought process earlier in instead of everything at the very end and putting it all on Shark Tank, is build and foster those relationships while you build out the company, the idea, the relationships, because it will help you. Maybe you never need to get to Shark Tank. Maybe you just bypass the, I don't know what the statistics are on that show, 80% fail rate or 50% fail rate, but it would definitely ultimately be the best to know an investor 5 years from when you need him, right?
Yeah.
Or somebody that knows how to do production in another country, or not production, but manufacturing.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
That's what they say. They just, whatever they say, that guy's like, yeah, I need that. Well, then go find it. There's got to be somebody in your town. Like my neighbor, once I moved away out of New Jersey, my neighbor, what was it? He worked in some importing and exporting of products from China.
Yeah.
And nobody had ever talked about it. And so I started asking around for, Tuiva for different components that I needed. And it's like, oh my word, was that really the neighbor that lived there for like 8.5 years? Like seriously, did we not? I mean, it's not like we barbecued, but goodness gracious, it was that close.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you keep your eyes open, conversations
of what we were engaged in outside of being neighbors, so that we knew the other person's aspirations were.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say I didn't know him, but it was my parents' neighbor that I grew.
Yeah,
it was the house right there. So, but it's like I'm going online, I'm trying to find this, I'm calling. Oh, some people say, oh, you should go on Shark Tank. Somebody knows somebody that's from. Goodness gracious, it's right there. But when you don't really think about it, or you don't talking about the idea, or you're not necessarily willing to share your dream, you may miss out on one of those little pieces of connection that could, you might not need it today, but you eventually will.
Yeah. So David, I have a question that I feel like I've been piecing together as we've been in conversation. And I just want to hear what your thought is on it. I've yet to, I think, pose this question to anyone on the podcast. Yet I feel like I've been mulling it over for a bit, right? Okay. Here's the question. So as we're moving through this process of being or becoming entrepreneurs, and as we accept the fact that not being successful is a part of the journey, how do we live through that within our network without conditioning them to expect a lack of success as the outcome of our endeavors, right? It's like, so to sort of paraphrase that idea, right? It's like, or the question. So I've gone through, I'm now, you know, X age, I've had seven ideas have made their way to different stages of being viable in the market, maybe some slightly successful, maybe some not so successful. I've been advocating, talking to my network, meeting people, right? Meeting investors, mm-hmm. folks, attorneys, other business folks, right? But at what point, or how do I know that I'm framing my journey in a way that is empowering as a part of this kind of learning-based experience versus one in which I just seem to, at every impasse, not be successful in what I intend to do?
Ooh, that's, I don't know how I'm supposed to answer all of that, but
I don't know either. That's the whole point.
Oh my goodness. I would put a lot of emphasis on a few different keys of the question.
Okay.
And again, we go back to, what road are you going down? The inventor is going to sit there and try to figure out the problem. And try to fix the problem. And then that's all he's going to do. And though a patent doesn't mean as much, I mean, Elon Musk has even said a patent is a lottery ticket for a lawsuit.
Yeah. But
he doesn't even care. He just speeds. He's first to market. That's what he does.
Yeah.
And so there's benefits, I think, to anything you say, you can kind of go your way, but How do you go to your network and be okay with failures? Is that kind of what you're asking?
I think that what we're describing and what we're advocating, I believe, in this episode is this idea that you determine what your approach is going to be, right? And and that. Either road, inventor or company, that you will need network and alliances and relationships to move that thing forward. I think it's also human nature to, even though I understand failure or I understand a lack of success as being a part of the process, that I don't necessarily want to show up for the things that weren't successful. Like, I don't want to include anybody in my process until I kind of know that this thing is a sure bet. I think that a lot of folks.
But I think that increases failure rate, though.
It does, right? So I think that a lot of folks may not endeavor in projects that may not be inherently successful for them or naturally successful for them, not necessarily because they're afraid of failure, but because they're afraid of the failure brand on them, right? Like, I don't know if I want to get into that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I need to project success. I think actually, as we're working through it, I think I'm actually there with my question, right? I think that in a success driven world where social media focuses on success, where metrics focus on success, where so much of who we are has been focused through this lens of, what have I done well? What can I be proud of? What do I want to showcase? How do we make space for failure? How do we make space for relationships in which we have to be vulnerable enough to share our fears, concerns, our lack of success? Because I feel like the roadmap for entrepreneurs is very, as much as we say, you know, we have to go through these not successful points to hit our win, to hit our success. I feel like the general temperament of the world is, well, I actually don't really want you. I don't really want to hear about your failures, right? Clue me in when you're successful, and then talk about that in the TED. Talk about your failures in the TED Talk.
Ooh, yeah. I think people are stuck. Isn't that like microwave generation, though? Where it's like people want success, you know?
Yeah. Like, I think we're obsessed with hitting the success point and then talking about our failures as a retrospective of our journey, as opposed to being transparent about it as we go through the process, because we're as a culture fascinated with the journey in retrospect, not necessarily the journey as lived or as currently.
That's part of the process. I've kind of pondered that. You're explaining it in detail, but I've pondered like the idea of why aren't more people rewarding failure with money?
Yeah.
Like just a little bit. Like there's nothing in it. There's nothing. There's no money in failure, but there is 90% learning.
Everyone says that there's learning in failure. Yet we shy away from it as a culture, as industries. We're like, you know, get in touch with me when you succeed, right? Because the process of failure, like, I don't really know what to do with you.
Yes. I guess there's so many different levels of failure. There could be bankruptcy is the worst type of failure. And then there's all these others above that people could judge based upon what this is and what that isn't. I mean, when I've talked about pitching companies, I was speaking with some soccer dad or mom, and they said, oh, my kid's school is starting the kids in, I don't know what grade, to write an idea and pitch it to five teachers that they don't know. And I thought, really? Well, that's a good idea, because now I'm getting to this at this age of my life. What if you were at this at high school and you had the programming skills? You know, could you have pitched your grandfather or grandmother for a couple $1,000 to get to the next level? You know, but then you have a whole nother spot that you don't know of marketing. So there's so many variables in the business world. But do I agree with you in we should be talking more about the things that might have not went well and how we can all learn from them? Absolutely. I don't know why there isn't. In fact, maybe we should start a podcast called We All Fail or something.
Losers. Stories of failure to help people.
Yeah, stories of failure, what not to do. Yeah,
because that's currently in, right? A lot of people. You're currently failing right now. Like, what's your thought process right now? Not what are you 5 years ago. You're looking back on it, right? Yeah, like you're like, oh, like I was in my car. No, I want you in your car right now. Like, what's happening right now?
What did you do? Well, I was pitching a venture capital on Zoom, going down the highway in my Tesla. Okay, guys, don't do that.
Exactly. But you know what? I think I've come to some sort of conclusion. And please, add on to this if you deem it appropriate. But I think maybe it comes down to the quality of relationships that you have, right? Like that if you're just asking your grandfather, if you ask your grandfather for money and that you fail, then your grandfather's going to approach it probably on a personal level. But if you have a mentor and you failed, that person's going to help you come to some realizations differently. And so if a lot of the network that you lean into is, if they're not really knowledgeable in what you're trying to undertake and you haven't formed a really healthy value-based relationship with them, then you might fear the brand of failing more than if you have a really solid relationship with people that understand your process, or that understand the process, your process, the process, and that can add their own stories and lessons learned from their experiences where maybe your failure isn't looked at as a failure, but just one more step closer toward success. Maybe. I don't know.
Well, it's the value of the relationship, but it's kind of on you. If you think that you have an idea and nobody else has thought of it, then you're the smarter one and you are absolutely tasked with the emotional strength of that relationship and the educational piece. And so I'll explain, you know what, in coding, you know what, if I just say V1, you know what that, like version one, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So everybody has multiple versions of it. So anything I do now, I teach my kids, I just go, the first version won't work out. Literally, when the first time I said that to them, I was like, it's coding. They're not going to know what that is. And then I would say sometimes, it's just a draft copy. And they're like, no kid playing with them knows what a draft is, except one. And he goes, it's a draft or beta. And I go, what? You knew? Your parents must be teaching you something. So the kids decided to make bread the other day. And they made it and it didn't come out. And they're like, that is the first version. It wasn't going to work.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah. You understand that if you do anything, there's a lot of like, I don't really care if it doesn't work. I'll just try it. And you do it. And then you're like, okay, I learned what not to do. We'll try it again. And I always say, like, you're not going to know that anything works until you bake bread five times. You're not really going to get it. It's rainy one day. There's more humidity in the air. It's different. The temperature is too hot, too cold. It's different. That's talking four variables. Yeah. Water, right? Salt, milk, sometimes flour, yeast. 4 to 5. That's it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Throw together a page of variables. That's just the system. Then you throw in a person that has 50 variables. I'm happy. I'm sad. I'm this. I'm that. Somebody passed away. All these things. And then throw in a marketing person, another person, and a meeting on Monday morning. And somebody's hungry. It's hard. So there is a lot of variables. So what I mean to say in it is it's your job as the entrepreneur to go into it with form of like, I'm gonna teach everybody a little bit about this thing that I really like, and they're just gonna respect. They're gonna like it because I like it, and because this is if you hold it to yourself, nobody knows what you're talking about. Nobody knows what V1 is. It's V1, and it wasn't gonna work. You spent 4 hours on that, and it doesn't work. Well, that sounds like a waste of time, but to you, it's not. So, is it V1? Is it V2? They know now. And I go, it's just first version. It looks like this. Okay, Dad, that's cool.
Yeah.
And then when you see it next time, this looks so much better. I didn't want to tell you. Okay, this is the thing. Again, now, if you don't tell me, I'm going to version 7, right, before we get somewhere. You know, if you don't tell me the bread is good or bad, we're going to version 10. So it is a little bit of, it's actually all of your responsibility. If you're the only entrepreneur, the only like idea person, or you have your own business and nobody else does, it's your job to kind of just go in there and be like, hey, this is what I'm doing. This is how I kind of need you to react when I say this. Try not to say it at 11:30 at night. Don't ask for advice at 2 o'clock in the morning, right?
Yeah.
Know when to do that. Don't get hurt if your grandfather or somebody else says no, if you haven't talked to him for 6 months about the idea, the concept, the relationships that you've yielded. I went to Panera's and had coffee with this guy and he said this and he grew up where you did. Isn't that cool? Yeah. And but you have to spend that time. And that's the company, remember? That's the company side, people. Yeah. Or you're an invention side where it's just a system. And you have to understand those two pieces. So,
and in addition, man, I think that as you're talking about this, I'm like, you know, it's a factor. You also need to understand people's relationship to failure itself, right? Like, you'll get a very different opinion if a person views failure or version one versus final version. If they view everything between V1 and final as problems, as emotional stressors, then you're probably going to hear some of that. And you may internalize some of that, right? And so I think being in deep relationship with people and sussing out from them not just their ability to understand your idea, but some understanding of their own aspirations, all right? Their own wins and failures and how they feel about those can really help, I think, to structure the type of information you share with them, right? Because if someone only sees the loss and failure, then you describing your journey may produce a different result than someone who has a different relationship to it, right? So your kids may come to you and you're like, they're like, we didn't do this right. You're like, that's awesome. Can't wait till you get it right, right? Where another person will go, well, then, you know, then making bread just not your thing.
Yeah. Ouch. Right? All that's sudden, absolutely right. Yeah.
Right? Then all of a sudden, like the kids never want to make bread again, right? Maybe then they never want to bake again, yep, and lose out on this passion that they could have had.
Yeah, you don't have a talent to bake like the other child. Yeah, and it's absolutely exactly nothing to do with it.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
It's like nothing. And that's where you're talking about before is if you there was some like reward with failing, I think society would be like 100 years in the future, because people would be like, I'll just try it. It'll just be fun. You know, instead of laying out in the sun for 4 hours, I'll just try something for 45 minutes and then lay out for 3 hours and three and a quarter hours. Like they would just do, they would try something for the fun of it.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, David. So we are at the close of the episode. I have two questions that I ask everyone who comes on Man Versus Brand. Really easy
going
question.
So well. I was like going to go for another hour here.
It could have. Listen, we have a failure podcast. We're gonna collaborate on.
I love it.
So on any streaming platform, a book, a podcast, what's something that you have recently engaged in that you thoroughly enjoy?
I will say I am not a huge into a specific. I love a lot of different types of music because the mood changes, and I love anything educational. And it sounds a little bit nerdy, but I just love things that I don't know. So I'm a big fan of like things like Udemy, where you can turn on how to do a tutorial and it's got like 16 hours on there. And sometimes they're really cheap. They'll send you like a push notification. It's like on sale for like $10. And you're like, oh, it's $190 course. And either I'm listening to music, you know, getting out of a funky groove or whatever that I might be down or something. And then I'm like, oh, I want to learn about something. And so I'll end up listening to somebody narrate and sometimes watch them on the screen talk about something that I don't know. And I just love it. I don't know why. Somebody called it like an edu-attic or something. Possibly. And I kind of thought, is that a condition? Because I might have it.
I think it's learning based. I think that certain people are just learning based and like learning is the default and the way that they approach life. I think some people are experience based, right? Where they're just like, I'm just gonna go out and do this thing. And so I'm learning based. Like you put me in front of like Skillshare is like a dream to me. I'm like, I'm gonna learn today how to do this
masterclass. You know that masterclass like keeps advertising. I'm telling my wife, I'm like, just get me the subscription for my birthday. Like I see like an actor on there and he's like, oh, the 10 things about acting. I'm like, ah, sounds interesting. I don't know about it. It's not really beneficial to anything in the business world, but it's, I don't know why. It's just, that seems interesting to me. I don't really like sports. I'm not into sports. This statistical side of that, the financial world, I love that. That's financials or statistics and, you know, interesting bits of information I don't know. So I love that kind of stuff. That's just my brain, though. I grew up, my dad used to bring home, he was an electrical contractor. I asked my brother why. I said, why did he bring home all that stuff? And he goes, oh, you didn't realize that was a research and development company. So they would buy like $1 million worth of stuff, build it in 80-20 aluminum, and then throw away half the items that didn't work. And my dad would pick up that stuff. Oh, that's going in the trash. Yeah, okay, I'll take it back to the garage. And we used to tinker with this stuff. So I'm thinking that might have come through in, you know, the childhood upbringing of why I like those kind of things.
Yeah, I mean,
it didn't help me in high school, but.
But see, you know what's interesting? I think that it allows for nonlinear thinking. I think that it actually supports a way of pulling different approaches and methods of approach to solve like a problem that could be approached from one specific way. Like, I don't know, a good example for me is like, I think I said while you're talking, like DJing, right? I learned that I love DJing, but what I love is matching sounds that seem completely different from one another and creating harmony with them, right? But like, I also look at problems that way. Like, I'm always looking at how do I harmonize these two very different ways of thinking. So for me, engaging in the activity of DJing, also speaking to the part of my brain that also works with abstract ideas, I don't think that it seems that way in approaching it. I also love period pieces. I am like a period piece nut, mostly because I think I like to see ideas that had started in one period of time and how that idea had moved forward towards where we are today. It's not really useful until you start thinking of innovation and how innovation works, or how linguistics work, right? What are we saying today, and how was that phrase used 100 years ago? And to me, all of that stuff is not useful, but also useful in a way. So yep. I'm going to say to you, like, maybe it's useful. It may not have like a transactional usefulness where it's like learning this thing is going to produce this result. But I think
that you have a value for it, right? And you can attribute value to it in something that you do, and therefore it is valuable.
Yeah. All right, cool. So that's one question. Second question is very similar. So on any streaming platform, podcast, book, what's something that you thoroughly enjoy that people in your network may not necessarily associate with you, right? What's a book you read, or a show you watch, a movie, an activity you love, a podcast you listen to, that folks, or music that you like, that folks may not necessarily attribute to you, but that you thoroughly enjoy?
A couple different things. I've been with the people side, you know, being so deep in tech. I was part of a multi-level marketing years ago when I was younger. And so we had to read like books on people. The Magic of Thinking Big was an eye-opener for me. That was a really great, How to Win Friends and Influence People, Dale Carnegie, a big popular book. Same thing, you know, coming from the tech world, when you start looking at the other side, I guess it's like them reading a text, a computer programming book, right?
Yeah.
But they did it in a certain way that it was like, that's really cool. I could see how that works. It was understanding. It was learning for me. I love those things. Movies, anything with tech in them. I remember watching when the first Iron Man came out. I came out of that theater like 3 feet off the ground. I was like, whoa, look what you could do with technology. That's so cool. You know how, and I would tell my wife, oh, you know how close that is. This is so close. This is so close. Yeah. And they got flying guys now. They put those little rocket things on their hands. They're flying around.
Yeah.
But like, you can almost see those things happen where other people are like, wow, that's really futuristic. But when you're in that field, you can kind of see it. So weird things ignite me versus others. It just depends. Like, I love all types of music. So it just depends on the mood.
So to talk about the MLM thing, quick question, or, you know, what you think, right? Like, for all the flack that MLMs get, and I get why. I get the recruitment aspect. I get the you know, you're not really selling something. You're really selling a philosophy around something. And I get, you know, in the way that they deal with capital, why it can be problematic. But I do think that MLMs, typically as a form of buy-in, the I'm going to use the term manipulation, but I'm not going to use the term manipulation. I'm just going to say buy-in. As a form of buy-in, they create personal empowerment programs, right? Because they need you to be excited. They need you to talk to people. A lot of people that enter into MLMs may not necessarily be the most social people. So a lot of the motivation around their socialization within their network and forming new relationships is based in the personal empowerment stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's interesting because if you take the problematic part of the MLM, the personal empowerment stuff, the culture stuff is great. It's fantastic. It is. And yeah. I think that more companies would invest in developing training programs and empowerment tools, like systems like that, because it, aside from what's not really great about the parts of the MLM, that section has tangible, real results. Like the buy-in, the culture, the advocacy, the way that people engage in being profitable and creating community around these MLM projects. You would think that other companies would be like, man, that looks great. I'm going to do that thing for my company to make my company explode and scale. Why do you think more companies aren't doing that sort of work? Is it because the recruitment aspect is so viable to the MLM that if recruitment is not a part of your company's profit, then...
No, it's because you didn't make this podcast any earlier. That's why. I mean, we started off with this whole thing about I want to get rich based upon my idea and my skill set, which is called an inventor.
And then we have the
people that actually want to build a company of people and relationships. And what's happening with major MLMs is they haven't listed the podcast yet. So they don't understand the difference between that inventor type of personality, which is a little bit more like, no, I don't want to tell you all my ideas right now. No. I could be rich and quick and I could find 10 people and I'm done. It's not about the 10 people. It's about, are you a leader that you can attract 10,000 people, that you can attract 100,000 people? Are you willing to put in that work? Look, the same work on the MLM side, if you do that in any major corporation, you'd make really good money.
And
I don't see the difference between an MLM and a basic store, you know, that you have to buy a product, take out rent, And then if you add two stores, add four stores, add five stores, 10 stores, then you're just going to have more people to deal with. But they're literally going out and scouring out there anybody that says, I want to be rich. I want to find something. If the recruitment went out and found people that only want to deal with people, they would flourish 100 times faster because it's all in the human relationship, right? It's relationship first, then the money. Or a business is a good relationship with money. Friendship with money. That's what I think is off with them. Their training is fantastic. Everything else is, well, not all of them, right? Like I was probably part of a good one. I never saw anything wrong with it. But I think that's what, I think they don't teach the lower level individuals to find people that are not just like, you find like, oh, just find somebody that has a big dream. Yeah, but you should ask them, do you want to deal with 1,000 people? Do you want 1,000 people to look at you and see how good you are? No, I don't like my face. Well, then you're probably not going to be a prime example for someone going, you know, triple striped, whatever they call it, you know.
But then I think what's fascinating about MLMs is that they can take a person like that and somehow create space for them and give them a track to follow on that makes that provides them with value. Like I find like MLMs can almost find a track for almost anyone, where so many companies fail at placing talented people on tracks that will end up in retention. One of the best things that MLMs do is some of the best retention strategies in the world. Like recruitment aside, like we can talk about recruitment all day in MLMs, but like they do really well with retention. Like people, and maybe it's the personality types, maybe it's a bunch of other things, right? The profit share parts and all that stuff. But
no, if a big company did that, wouldn't you stay if you worked at Target and they had some sort of retention? Hey, you bring five people in, they'll be yours forever. Goodness gracious, nobody would quit.
Exactly. So you think that more companies would just be like, that seems like a really great idea, and are would able to sort of separate the parts of it that, you know, success leaves clues, the parts of it that don't really work for them, right, in their model, and the parts that would be applicable to really supporting what their overall mission is.
Yeah, and,
All right, cool. Listen, guys, I hope you appreciated this episode. David, thank you so much for sharing your expertise, your thoughts. I want folks that would be interested in Twevo to not only find out more about the company, but also find out about more about what you're doing in that space. So where can people connect with you in social spaces to find out more about what you guys are doing over there and maybe just some more of your stuff that you're putting out there? Where can they find you?
So anywhere, just search Twevo. We picked a very easy name so that we can fit right in there with Google, Twitter, Facebook, Meta, right? Meta now. Yeah, yeah. And Twevo. And it's like, it's simple. So it's like, hey, Dad, can you put my video on Twevo TV? Me kicking the soccer goal in at the Saturday event. And let's sit at Chili's and eat. So it's very easy. It's T-W-E-V-A, Twevo.com. Yep. And just hit us up on any of the social media. You know, and what we're trying to do is build out a bunch of content creators and small businesses that want to kind of build their own TV channels for their cities. So if you want like cheap advertising, you have podcasts, you have photography groups, anything, start creating content and create it for horizontal. Like it's a little different than the phone now. It's you create it horizontal for the TV. But yeah, jump on the website, say hi, let's chat.
Yeah. All right, cool. Listen, guys, check show notes for all information on how to get in contact. If you can't find Twevo, I'll make sure to have it spelled out for you down there. We're also going to share, David, your two preferences. We're going to talk about Udemy. We're also going to get into some other spaces of your preferences. That's the way that we work on Man versus Brand. Thank you so much for sharing this hour with me. This has been an amazing talk. I hope you guys got as much from it as I've gotten. Thank you, David. Thank you, guys. Please share, like, subscribe, listen, give this to a friend. I thank you all. I love you all. Bye.
This talk just resonated with you or could help someone you know. Follow Dion or his guest on all social media platforms. Till next time. And remember, with any business or brand, give it your heart, make it real, or else forget about it. See you all soon. Follow Dion or his guest on all social media platforms. Till next time. And remember, with any business or brand, give it your heart, make it real, or else forget about it. See you all soon.